Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Watershed Cinema podcast.
This is the Marchy March and the Funky Bunch.
A mini munch.
Yeah.
Mini munch.
Mini March.
Mini March.
Late March.
Late March.
I'm back, baby. Took a while.
They're blooming back, but you've been busy. You've been doing Berlin.
Been ill, lying in bed.
Yeah.
Had annual leave.
Yeah.
Been in London.
Yeah.
Finally, back in the shed. Not been seen in weeks.
How does it feel to be back?
Hmm.
How does it feel? That is a very good note. What was it? I was watching a video of Amelia de Moldenberg asking what's the worst red carpet questions to ask.
Ooh.
And one of them is, how do you feel?
Who asks that?
Journalists.
Oh.
Journalists, they go, how do you feel?
How do you feel about being here? How do you feel having won? Yeah.
Yeah. It's good because it's an open-ended question, but it's kind of like, it's kind of a nothing question. There's nothing to hold on to. So
how do you feel
as a bad journalist? How do you feel to be back?
What are your four favourite films?
slightly better.
I saw them in Berlin on the
Letterboxd.
Yeah, and they were like, excuse me, do you have Letterboxd? Do you want to tell us your four favourite films to the camera? And it was after my fourth film of the day that I'd seen, and I was just so like mentally fried, and I just wanted a beer, and I was just walking past, and I was like, no.
Oh.
No.
I'm gutted you didn't go for it. You could have been Letterboxd famous.
I was like, I can't be seen in this state, basically.
That's
fair enough. There's nothing behind the eyes at this point. I couldn't speak.
After the fourth film.
Yeah, and then I went and watched another one because why not?
Yeah. How many films
YOLO
did you watch?
40 across like nine days. Yeah, it was like five a day.
When you told me that, I was like, because I've watched, what was it? I think seven films in 2 days.
Yeah, and that
my brain was
you.
Fried. But I don't
it
know how.
It gets the point where I'm like, I don't know. It's just images on a screen, isn't it?
It's a moving image.
The last one I watched was a 3+ hour documentary called Henry Fonda for President, which was excellent. Mm. But it was like Adam Curtis-esque type thing.
Oh, cool.
But better. But after that, I was like, I'm tapping out. I could have fit in two more, but I was like, no. Brain's turned off. I'm going to go have some oysters.
Some oysters in Berlin?
Yeah.
Not currywurst?
No. Mm. Not really a sausage person.
Mm, fair enough. We didn't talk about the Oscars. No, we didn't. And that's why I'm wearing my hoodie, which everyone can see in the podcast. But
they can feel it.
Give a visual description of what you can see.
It's big, it's fluffy, and it's Knuff.
It's Knuff. I'm wearing the...
I am Knuff official fleecy hoodie.
Which was gifted by you and Ellie.
Happy birthday.
For my birthday. And I'm very appreciative of it. And it is very, very
comfy.
Because
you're Knuff.
I am Knuff, and I'm waving at you.
Ow! Oh, that was a really bad high five. It was painful and quiet.
But it happened.
Yeah.
But you
don't
can
cry because it's over. Cry because it happened.
Is that what
I don't even know.
Is that what they all said after the Oscars?
I loved Al Pacino's announcement of Best Picture.
Oppenheimer.
My eyes see Oppenheimer. Just the pause. So that's the way to do it.
Well, I mean, like he got on with the business. Do you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, no faffing about.
No.
He's such a silly man. I love him. You seen a Shrek phone case? Sorry, that's completely...
No. Yeah. Oh, wait, no, but you've told me about this.
Yeah.
Shrek phone
case. He goes
case.
Jogging around in like LA or whatever, and the paparazzi pictures, he has this like Shrek phone case.
He's got
it's just
good
got
loads
of pictures
taste.
Of Shrek's face on it. I think he said his like granddaughter got it for him or something.
Sweet.
Anyway, that's not the point of the podcast.
No, but another excellent moment is Messi the dog. From Anatomy of a Fall.
Clippy clapping.
Actor extraordinaire. Definitely clapping with his definite paws.
Yeah, yeah. Those are his. I won't hear anything to the contrary.
No, that's...
That dog can clap.
Yeah. Impressive.
Wee.
Best dog of the year, I think.
He won the The Palm Dog. Christ, Palm Dog. That took me a long time to remember the name of it. I was like, it's a pun somewhere, but I can't remember. I was trying to make it into the poor door, and I was like, that's not it. But no, each year they give out an award to the best dog performance. And Messi the dog was your winner.
At Cannes?
Yeah. Oh. Round Cannes.
Oh, very. Have you seen a clip of him showing how he dies? He's incredible.
On cue. He's a great performer.
Yeah, good dog.
Arguably better than Robert Downey Jr. Didn't say that.
So it's Oscars a couple days post Oscars.
Yeah. Anyway, March, mid-March, as we said.
Yes.
I mean, we're still holding Perfect Days, which is lovely. Vim Wenders Tokyo Toilet film, which I think we probably talked about last podcast because it opened at the end of February. Well, yeah, as we're already halfway in, I did want to talk about our March rep season, which we've already had two films of, but given that March is a rather long month. There are actually 5 Sundays in March.
Yes, there are.
Did you know?
Yeah.
So our season for this month is called Last Movies, and we're presenting it in partnership with...
Stanley Stinter.
Yes.
Yes.
Writer and curator Stanley Stinter, who's put together... This is his kind of ongoing project called Last Movies, part of which is a book which has been published by Bristol-based independent publisher Tenement Press, who we're partnering with on the season. So as well as being a book, it's also an ongoing series of screenings presented at various venues, various cities, in different forms as well. So like at the ICA, it's been a bit like ours of an ongoing programme, but the films have been presented with conversations. Whereas for us, it's every Sunday, we're presenting a different film. So the idea of the season and the central idea of the project is it's a kind of remapping of the last century of cinema according to the final films watched by a selection of notable figures or stars. So the only kind of criteria for selection almost within the project in terms of the films that are picked is the kind of level of fame or notoriety of the person that means that we know what their final film they watched was.
Yeah.
Because, of course, most people's lives aren't catalogued in such a way that you know for sure what their final film they saw was.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, some of these are... on the more speculative end, like it was in It Could Have Been This, It Could Have Been That. But there's some that you kind of know for definite, sometimes because they died midway while watching a film. So Stanley and I put together a season of these screenings, picking out 5 kind of titles and figures that we're presenting over the course of the month. So we started off with From Russia With Love, which is the final film seen by JFK. And we also showed an excerpt from the film War Is Hell by Bert Topper, which was the final film or part of a film seen by JFK's assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. Because after the assassination, he was hiding from the FBI, from the police, in a movie theater. And he watched up to this kind of 15-minute mark before they found him, and he was like dragged down and arrested on the street outside. You know, apparently that there's so many little facts and details around each of these in the book. It's someone described it as like excellent pub quiz material. But I think it was the popcorn guy at the theater where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested. Immediately after it happened, he went out and grabbed the chair that Lee Harvey Oswald was sat on in the cinema and like removed it, and then later auctioned it off as being the seat that was sat on by JFK's killer.
That's dark.
It is.
That is a dark aspect.
It's also
of
weirdly like entrepreneurial.
Yeah,
I move like, in the moment.
I feel equally girl boss, but I also feel that is
dark.
Yeah, to exploit like a very dark moment in human existence.
But also fair play. I mean, it's probably on minimum wage on the popcorn machine. Anyway, so that was the first week. And then we just played last weekend Piano, the Jane Campion film, which was the last film seen by Kurt Cobain. He watched it with some friends at a movie theater the night before he died. I'm aware this project comes across as sounding quite morbid, but it's meant to be more like a kind of exploration of the role of like chance and fate in shaping a program or a kind of history of film.
I think what's interesting about the season is the film selection is quite mainstream and accessible.
Yeah, because
so
it's kind of influenced by the kind of films that people watch. Mm. As in that this whole idea of it remapping a history of cinema is the idea that these are the films that people were actually watching in their lives. It's not like people, I mean, with very few exceptions, pick their final film. It's not like your last meal.
Yeah.
You know, as a death row inmate, that's a real deliberate choice of what's going to be the last thing I ever eat. These are often just down to chance because people typically don't plan their own deaths. But again, with exceptions, because there's people like Jean-Luc Godard, who of course died by assisted suicide in Switzerland a few years back. So of course, his film, you can take as being a bit more of a deliberate decision.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he watched his own film, his final film.
Which is kind of iconic.
It is. There was also a weird fact about his death that came out. I think it was Stanley said it in a podcast, maybe, or maybe it was in the book. But his appointment at the clinic was at like 9 or 10 in the morning. But like because of the kind of process of the appointment and how long everything takes throughout the day, he didn't actually die until like 3 or 4 p.m. in the afternoon.
Right.
But he arranged for his death to be announced in the morning. And according to someone who was with him at the time,
but he wasn't dead yet.
Of his death, he spent the day reading his obituaries as they came in, which absolutely blew my mind. I was like, that's
controlling the narrative.
He's probably the only person in history that's able to do that and to see the response to their own death. Because, I mean, you have people who like fake their death for whatever reason, like fraud or whatever. But, you know, so they might potentially see their own funeral. You know, there's often that trope in thrillers of someone standing at the tree at the back of their own funeral, you know, watching on. But no, here he actually was reading the reception to the news of his own death, which is, I just find weird to think about.
Yeah, it is.
It keeps bugging me. It keeps coming back up when I'm just like walking along and I keep thinking, oh.
Would you want?
No.
No.
Dear God, no.
Okay.
Would you? I feel like it's quite a childish fantasy thing, no?
Yeah, it's
a preoccupation of a lot of kids of like, oh, what would everyone in school say if I died, you know?
Yeah, I suppose when you say that it's kind of immature, that does make sense. But I suppose it's also...
Oh, I don't mean for him immature. I just meant like it's quite feels like quite a preoccupation of childhood to want to see the reception to your own death.
Yeah, it's like you literally being the angel watching over... how people are responding to you, which is probably the only guaranteed way that you could actually make that happen, religions and faiths aside. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I highly recommend the book. There's so many interesting little facts in there. And it's highly, well, thoroughly, very thoroughly researched. I think it was an ongoing project for several years. And in fact, we did an event with Bookhouse.
Yes.
Like a book launch reading type evening, which was great. An upcoming, on the 17th, we're playing The Sound of Music, which is the final film seen by Joseph Breen, who was the administrator of the Hays Code for several decades.
And what is the Hays Code if people don't know what it is? Okay.
A set of industry guidelines for the self-censorship of content that was applied to most motion picture releases by major studios in the United States from 34 to 68.
Cool.
It was the whole thing like,
it's the age,
you know, if they're on the bed, they need a foot on the floor kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? So it can't get too sexy.
Okay. Yeah. And then the
good guys
kisses.
Have to win. You know, you can't have your villains getting away with things.
Oh,
of course, it
like
changed shape over the time it was enacted, but it was basically the moral kind of.
So what, during that time, you couldn't have like a sad ending?
Well, for part of it, yeah. Like you couldn't have a villain win. Basically, which I'm like, how does that then shape a whole kind of generation of people whose exposure to media and narratives is...
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can't remember when that finished. I think that was earlier on.
Because I thought the Hays Code was just kind of a precursor to, I don't know, stuff like the BBFC of age ratings of PG, 15, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, it kind of... Yeah, I mean, there were various, but the code mainly prohibited like profanity. You couldn't have any suggestive nudity, graphic, realistic violence. Yeah, quite a lot of the stuff that now forms. I mean, you look at that and coming out of that into like 70s cinema, and it makes a lot of sense. A kind of reaction against those prohibitions that had been in place before.
And so the person who watched The Sound of Music was the person who created the Hays Code.
Or administered it,
administered.
So it was in charge of enforcing it.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So a nice little PG number. No, a U.
U, it's a U.
A rare U. It's for a U. Us.
Yeah.
Could trade it before.
It's family friendly. Yeah.
And then we've got the following Sunday, Barry Lyndon, Stanley Kubrick film, which is the last film seen by Charlie Chaplin.
You are a liar. You're an imposter. You're a deserter.
He seems to me little more than a common opportunist. I don't think he loves my mother at all.
Kubrick himself lent it to Chaplin, and Chaplin sent him back a telegram saying how much he'd loved the film.
Wow.
Which there's a picture of online. You can Google it.
Oh, that's really cool.
And we'll also be playing, before Barry Lyndon, the very brief Eyes Wide Shut trailer, because that was the last thing seen by Stanley Kubrick before he died.
Oh, what, the trailer?
Yeah, he was quite fastidious in his control over the trailers for his films.
That makes sense.
Part of that. Yeah,
that makes a lot
of
sense.
Sometimes like, more directors should have more oversight over the trailers.
I gotcha.
Nothing worse than a bad trailer.
No names.
And then we finish up on Easter Sunday with Oedipus Rex, Paolo Pasolini film, which was Pasolini's last film. He watched it as part of like a, not quite a retrospective, but like a recognition kind of event of his work. It was screened and then he gave a talk, I think.
It's also iconic behaviour. It's similar to getting the obituaries in before you've died.
It's quite iconic.
Yeah.
It's also an excellent film. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a big Pasolini fan, but yeah, so I mean, this is just our kind of involvement in the project and a collaboration we've had, but it's continuing in various other forms. You'll be screening a close-up as like a durational artwork, I guess. I think there was over a full day. I can't remember if he said 12 or 24 hours, but like continuous screening of these like final films.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, where those were interrupted viewings, like War is Hell, they'll be screened to the segment that was watched.
Mm-hmm.
The project's been described by Laura Mulvey as very strange and deeply thought-provoking.
That's a very good quote.
It is. Very that's like, that's on the back cover, I think. So
and
highly
we're
recommend
selling
getting
the
Oh, and we're selling the book at box office throughout March, so do pick up a copy.
They're very pretty.
Yeah, I mean, crisp graphic design.
I like the paperback version, the bold yellow.
Yellow jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very pretty.
Come get your books.
For a limited time.
That's the Sunday season. And as we're entering this in mid-March,
should
we start with March 15th?
Let's do it.
Yeah. We've got Monster. It's the return of Hirokazu Koreeda, who follows up Shoplifters and Broker with another kind of bittersweet family drama in the form of Monster. It leans into, I would say, slightly darker themes than the... Mind you, I suppose Broker was about technically child abductors, but...
Yeah, but it was kind of a bit jolly.
Yeah. This is slightly darker. But it's this like really delicately layered thriller that traces the same set of events from three perspectives in that kind of like Rashomon-esque fashion.
That's what I was going to say. And I also need to see Rashomon as well.
It's a double billet. Monster features the final score of Japanese composer Ryuichi
Sakamoto.
Yeah, am I saying that right? As I said it, I was like...
Ryuichi Sakamoto.
Yeah. Producer Bernie
Ryuichi
saves
Sakamoto.
The day again.
Thank you, Bernie.
And he's the star of another, or features at the centre of another March release, Opus, which I shall just briefly jump to in connection with this, which we're showing from the 28th of March, which is a Thursday, so that's technically a preview, and then it opens the day after on the 29th, but the 28th marks the one-year anniversary since his death, and the film is a kind of moving record of his final performance, which was given on the eve of his death. So it kind of takes the form of an elegy almost, and of him revisiting his kind of monumental body of work.
Mm.
And it's not like a public performance. It's performed in a studio. So it's got that kind of edge of This Much I Know to Be True. I think the latest one where it's kind of beautifully shot studio performance. This one has slightly less wild camera work than was in the cave one, but it's a beautiful film. Also on the 15th, Drive Away Dolls. Ethan Coen, writer director, is split from his brother Joel, who did The Tragedy of Macbeth. That was his kind of solo effort from a few years back. And here Ethan has joined up with his wife, Trisha Cook, to produce a screenplay they've had in the works for a while, since the 2000s, for this kind of quite wild road trip, kind of caper of two lesbian friends caught up in crime.
Cool.
It had a different original title.
What was it?
I don't know if I should say on the podcast. But
In
relation to this, I can talk about the Ethan Coen polycule story, which had completely passed me by until the news of this film coming out did the rounds on Twitter.
Okay.
And I think I told you about this at the time. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you'll have to remind me.
But so Trisha,
who is
produced this film with, who's his wife.
Yeah.
She said, Ethan asked me on a date and we went to see Drugstore Cowboy. I told him, I'm a lesbian, I'm not interested. So then they became friends for a while, but the relationship evolved and they married in 93 and had two kids together. And so, you know, she says, being married to Ethan and being queer, there's always a little disconnect sometimes. I wanted to be able to make queer films as well. And so they decided in the, like, 2000s, so quite early, you know, a while back now, that they should write a feature screenplay, which is the original screenplay for this film, Drive Away Dolls.
It's
been in the works for a very long time. And they kind of wrote it as a way for them to spend time together. But by then, the couple were no longer in a traditional partnership. Cooks described it as a very non-traditional marriage where there's a bigger unit. She has a partner and Ethan has another partner. And I just never knew this about the Coen bro.
I mean,
this was
good for them.
Yeah, exactly. It's a wild ride.
What? Don't touch it. I saw this movie once where they come across this box. And they opened the box.
The case.
And it was, like, really, really bad.
I just want to know what's going on.
I bet it's locked.
We just want to locate your friends.
Who are you, jackass?
That's when women curse like that.
Those girls just drove off with something we need.
We gotta call the cops.
Cool your jets. Here's what we do. Sell it back. Shake them down.
That is about the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And I'm a cop.
Yeah, baby.
Jack. Who are you?
Save the sanctimony.
And hand over the million smackers.
We should see what's in here.
On that weekend as well, on the Sunday 17th of March, we're also offering a free Southwest Shorts showcase.
Yes.
As part of National Lottery Open Week, which is where they say, hashtag thanks to you for supporting National Lottery projects and playing the National Lottery with their little cross finger, which is...
I mean, marketing strategy aside, it is a way of saying, like, a lot of films that get funding from BFI Network.
Yeah, a lottery funded. And lots of our activity is. So yeah. The idea, I mean, we put together this idea for the Southwest Short Showcase is like a way of highlighting all of the aspects of our work that national lottery funding makes possible, both in terms of supporting local filmmaking through BFI Network Shorts, but also our work in exhibition and showing films. So this is the idea was to combine the two here. So we'll be screening a selection of works produced through BFI Network Southwest over the last 5 years on the big screen, and it's free. You just need to produce a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
And book a ticket. You have to book. Don't just rock up on the day.
Yes.
So we have an idea of numbers.
Bring your scratch card.
But yeah. Sunday midday.
Yeah.
Come along.
There's some really good shorts.
Yeah.
In that. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a little pre-watch in the cinema.
Yeah.
They look great up on the big
Southwest
screen.
Is very talented.
I know.
Deeply talented.
Filmmaking talent.
Honestly.
Then looking ahead to the week after, we've... got a special preview Q&A on Thursday 21st of Silver Haze, directed by Sasha Pollack, director of Dirty God. Silver Haze here not being the weed strain, although maybe, thinking about it, yes, it is. But we're not offering you weed, it's just that's the...
Free baggy with every ticket, what?
Oh, now that's a good deal. Uh-huh. And it's also not the debut album from Jim Jarmusch's band Squirrel. It is a beautifully shot slice of life study. And we'll be joined by the main actor, Vicky Knight, for that preview Q&A on the 21st before the film opens on the 29th. So Vicky plays Frankie, a young nurse from like a rough working class family. Her mum's an alcoholic and her sister Leah, who's actually played by Vicky's real life sister, Charlotte, is in a relationship with an abusive partner. And Frankie's got her own kind of problems alongside that. As a child, she was badly burned in a fire in her dad's pub, and she's convinced that the fire was caused by the woman her dad had had an affair with and since started a new family with, but she doesn't have any evidence. And it's a kind of trauma that she's unpacking and working her way through throughout the film. And she meets Florence, a rather disturbed young woman, who, because Vicky's a nurse, she meets her at the place where she works, because Florence has just attempted suicide and turns up on the ward, and they find themselves like drawn to each other. And the screenplay was actually partly based on Vicky Knight's own experiences, and it kind of beautifully captures the humour, tone, rhythms of kind of working class life without a kind of condescension. To throw the word authenticity in there, but it's like it feels genuine, and it's got an excellent supporting cast as well, including the someone who plays the grandmother, TV actor Angela Bruce, who is someone that just looks incredibly familiar when you see her, and you're like, oh, she was, oh, I know where's her face from? Do you know? She gives an excellent performance as Florence's ailing grandmother. And it then kind of turns into an almost like a found family film towards the end. It's very beautiful. Really pleased to have Vicky here for the Q&A. And then, yeah, we're playing the film when it opens at the end of the month.
I'm Frankie. I'm one of the nurses.
Hello.
What happened to you?
I was in a fire when I was a kid.
I've just got a message from someone saying that Jane's confessed to starting the fire.
So,
what have you been doing?
What's your problem?
Scared?
Nervous.
Why?
What does she do again?
Stop asking me questions!
So, Florence, where are you from?
No, I live in Southend with my nan.
This is Frankie. She's going to stay for a few days, all right?
Yeah, sure.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
She's a really good woman.
I just don't get it.
At the very beginning, the essence of it was love. In the air.
Frank, what's more important? Justice or answers?
After the fire, Deuce would say to her, who's going to want to be with her?
Frankie.
Let go.
And truly live your life.
22nd of March. Plowing on. We've got Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. Great title.
Yeah, it really rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. I've started calling it just Do Not Expect Too Much, which even that feels a bit...
I fear
just
the
don't
week
expect too much,
when I have to do all the printed bits and pieces and how I'm going to shorten that on like our weekly listing flyer. And
do you need TMFTEO? Oh, God.
That.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to do not expect dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
So we just refer to it as do not expect.
I've just been calling it the new film from Rowdy Jude. But then everyone's like, what film are you on? Anyway, Jude follows up 2021's Berlinale winning Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn with this kind of dizzying social critique.
Mm. In two parts.
Yeah, it is. It's quite a long film. Some interesting mix of black and
white.
Oh
yeah, I didn't check the duration on it. How long is it?
I'm not going to tell you. You can find out for yourself.
Fine, gotcha.
Book your ticket and then look at the runtime. It's kind of like this wild attack on the zeitgeist. It's kind of witty, mischievous work about work, basically. It's a work about the artifice of work. It's absurdist. It's comedic.
It sounds cracking.
So part one, kind of you follow Angela, an overworked production assistant who drives around Bucharest in order to film the casting for a Safety at Work video, which is commissioned by like a multinational company, ostensibly to raise awareness among its own employees of the different dangers that lead to work-related accidents. But she then kind of comes to realize in the process of collecting these testimonies and speaking to these people that she's basically got to get them to say on camera that it was all down to their failure to like wear a helmet and to make it an issue of personal responsibility rather than liability for the business, and all for a petty €1,000 fee for collecting all these interviews.
God.
So it's quite a miserable start for Angela here. And her bit of pleasure in life is by posting clips to her TikTok where she pretends to be Andrew Tate or an Andrew Tate-esque character, spewing kind of misogynistic bile and expressing her adoration for Putin. And those videos are in colour, whereas the rest of her life is presented in this quite like grainy, gritty monochrome. It's all presented like in jest, though. You know, obviously it's not endorsing Andrew Tate-type perspectives. It's meant to be a broader critique on... That's put in the producer's stomach. We all just need a bigger break. Maybe I should bring donuts next podcast.
Maybe.
That would be a shout.
Maybe.
I love a good American cop breakfast, you know, like a black coffee.
Yeah,
and just a sugar ring donut or an iced one with sprinkles on.
Very Twin Peaks.
Simpson. Oh, yeah.
Very Twin Peaks.
Exactly. Yeah. My friend just started watching Twin Peaks and I sent her that video of Angelo Badalamenti talking about how he composed Laura Palmer's theme. And it's, have you seen that video? It's stunning.
I don't think so.
He talks about how like David was sat next to him while he was composing at the keyboard, and David's just describing how we're in a windy patch and forest and it's dark and it's quite sad, Angelo. And then Angelo plays this theme and he's like, no, but it's slower. And then she emerges as a girl. And she's getting closer and closer, and the music kind of starts building to the climax of that kind of major chord at the peak of Laura's theme. And then he's like, and then she retreats, she's leaving, she steps back, and we're back returning to the cold, dark woods. Oh man, it's just a stunning video. That was a very weird segue, but
Cheryl
do,
and me,
do
yeah,
yeah, check out on YouTube.
Afterwards.
Yeah, Rowdy Jude.
Yeah.
Watch it, it's great. One for the cinema, partly because of its runtime. That'll keep your attention. Nothing like the audience policing each other's behaviour to stop you scrolling through Twitter and watching a long film.
Be nice to each other, all right?
Yeah, but also don't go on Twitter when you're at the cinema. Come on.
Yeah.
Have some decency.
But be nice and respectful, please. Thank you, please.
No, attack each other. Throw popcorn. Also on the 22nd of March, Late Night with the Devil. The third feature from Australia's Ken's brothers, Colin and Cameron.
The Knuff crew.
Yeah. Colin and Cameron are Knuff.
Kind
of.
We'll work.
It's just because I can't. All I look at.
Just looking at my
all
hoodie.
All I can see.
Just looking
when I look
at my
over there is
beautiful
Knuff.
Hoodie.
It's
kind of like my secret sequel to Give Me Pity.
Yeah. I think I described it when I confirmed it on the cello board as like the dark.
That was a good pitch
evil
for me.
Little older sibling of Give Me Pity. It's a kind of a network broadcast devolves into supernatural chaos. It's like a found footage horror almost, which combines like this, yeah, the kind of talk show setting. There's almost elements of King of Comedy in it, the Scorsese film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I need to watch that.
Oh, it's excellent. Mm. And yeah, it's such a like nasty little genre film. Not nasty in like, just as in like there's weird occult stuff going on all within this kind of TV set of the like late night variety, set in the 70s, and it's got that beautiful kind of grainy edge to it.
Mm-hmm.
And stars David Dastmalchian, I think you say his name, Dastmalchian.
Mm-hmm.
He's often been a supporting actor in things like Ant-Man, and he plays a creepy guy quite well. Mm-hmm. And in this, it's so great to see him take to like a leading role.
Yeah, he's a presenter of the show, isn't he?
And he's got like this weird charm about him, and then this like desperation that comes out as the events start unfolding around him halfway through. Yeah, what a ride. Definitely spend a late night with Late Night with the Devil.
On Halloween night, 1977, America gathered around for a live TV event that shocked the nation. What happened was real. What you are about to see is the recently discovered master tape of what went to air that night.
Ladies and gentlemen, now, here's Mr. Midnight, Jack Dalmore.
Late Night with the Devil.
On the Devil front, we have more to add.
This is an addendum.
Addendum.
So I heard the other day...
This is the voice of producer Bernie.
...that you cannot have a seance in the watershed as part of the licensing agreement.
That's
because good. There's too many spirits... Or it's built on some burial ground or something.
I have heard some haunting stories.
Have you?
Have you?
I can't remember who from, which is really annoying. I've got such a bad memory that I can't remember who told me it, so now I don't even know who to go to ask them to repeat it. Do you know where I did do a seance, though?
Where?
At the Cube...
Oh, because they're fine. They're not on a burial ground.
Well, we did one of those like cleansing ceremonies.
Oh, cool.
I don't know. It was like 2 or 3 a.m. and I wasn't going to say no at that point. And then we all started holding hands and there was holy water sprinkled over one of the speakers, I think.
Oh.
It was to get the devil. There was an evil spirit supposedly trapped in the speaker. I think personally the speaker had just got some water in it and stopped working. But that's open to interpretation. It was a fun night either way.
Do you think we need one in the watershed?
Maybe is what I'm hearing, but apparently against licensing. Maybe we'll have a word next podcast.
But if it's a clearing, clearing.
Could sage the
it's
place.
It's not exactly a seance, is it?
Yeah.
Maybe we should sage the place.
Seance St. Knowles.
Hey. 28th of March.
28th of March.
Is the first in a new kind of collaboration we're doing, Bristol Experimental and Expanded Film, BEEF.
Yes.
We're working together with them on a programme called Conspirators of Perception. There'll be three events in total, and we're looking at one a month in March, April, May, with the first one being on the 28th of March, called The Commonplace Unraveled, the films of Tara Najd Ahmadi, who's an Iranian artist and filmmaker whose kind of body of work focuses on creating a panorama of like rarely heard or marginalised stories. She uses a camera in quite a playful way to explore those kind of subtle socio-political nuances beneath our like everyday lives and experience. So we'll be screening 7 of her shorts from 2011 through to a few made in 2023. And it'll be a great night. So we'll be screening those and she'll be joining us for a Q&A via Zoom. And it will be presented in partnership with BEEF, and it's also been supported by the West of England Visual Arts Alliance and the Brunswick Club. And through the Weaver funding, we will be having there'll be descriptive subtitles for all of the shorts, and the Q&A will be BSL interpreted.
Yes. Beautiful.
Which is great. And then the following event as part of that season will be on April 25th when we're screening Hiding in the Lights, of experimental feature film from director Katrina Dashner, who will be joining us for, again, a Zoom Q&A following the film, which will be hosted by Ren Scatani. And then the final event will be a screening of some of the films of David Lester, in a kind of expanded format.
Mm.
Date TBC sometime in May. Keep an eye on the website. The final film I wanted to talk about for the month, released the very end on the 29th, is The Sweet East.
One of my favourite things I've seen this year.
Yeah.
It looks so
really
cool.
Divisive, especially speaking to people up in London last weekend. Like,
oh, really?
Joan from QFT did not, well, not a fan.
Oh, no.
Oh my god. I only fell off the stage.
Oh my god. Are you okay?
Oh my god, the recording of that. That might be great. No, please don't.
I have no idea how that happened.
I don't know how that happened. I didn't even see you move.
It was incredible, though. The devil got Bernie. The devil got producer Bernie.
It's cursed.
And pushed him off his seat.
The devil moves in mysterious ways.
Mm. What film are we talking about?
The Sweet East. Released on March 29th. I really liked it. It's, I think, the debut film of Sean Price Williams, who's often the frequent collaborator with the Safdie brothers as their cinematographer, kind of making his mark on modern indie American filmmaking for a while, like since the early 2000s. But here, with his first features, him as the sole director, it's quite different. It's written with Nick Pinkerton, who, among other things, is also a film critic in his own right. It's a weird kind of adventure film.
It looks like Alice in Wonderland, and you meet loads of weird characters
like
along the way.
Weird Wizard of Oz kind of American road trip. It's an anthology road trip film, essentially, where this teenage girl called Lillian escapes off of her school trip in Washington, D.C., and finds herself propelled out of her kind of ordinary suburban American life into a quite wild world of eccentric characters, and like this buzzing ambient violence throughout, which turns sinister at various points. And I don't want to, there are no spoilers on here, but
it's wild. Okay, it's wild. Okay.
Beth, excuse me!
Oh my god, oh my god.
We're not a threat. Don't look at us like that. Sorry, I'm...
Yeah, no.
Excuse me? You sure you're in the right place? Feel certain I've never seen you at one of these affairs before.
Little Bo Peep has lost her way.
I don't think she'd be scared. I think she's really braver than you think.
The election was a pre-scripted puppet show, just like every year.
You two are a complete pair of cosmopolitan snobs, you know that, yeah?
I need to know what's going on down in that basement now.
What in your young life could you have encountered to inspire you?
I don't know. I never really cared about that stuff. Glad they figured out how to make movies like less boring than this.
Did they?
No, I do know that. I don't like being like told things about myself.
No, but wait, I don't have your number.
Oh, I don't have a cell phone.
It's got an amazing supporting, you know, it's got A.O. Edebiri as well, Jacob Elordi, Jeremy O'Harris, Freewheeling Odyssey.
Is
I had
quote?
A lot of fun with it. It is a quote, yeah.
Freewheeling Odyssey, all right.
Do you want another one?
Go on.
A sly, self-conscious State of the Nation address. But Talia Ryder is great as the central protagonist, Lillian, as she encounters artists, actors, anarchists, neo-Nazis, all variety of sinister weirdos. I think it's definitely worth checking out. I'm really excited to see what he makes next. And it's, one of the top films of the year for me so far. That's me for March. It's quite a lot, isn't there? I mean, given that's half a month. There's a lot of one-offs and Q&As this month as well.
Yeah,
it's been
loads.
A month of Q&As. There's been like nine.
Left, right and centre.
I don't like turning people down. I like doing things. I like being a yes person. But in the immortal words of Bradley Cooper in Maestro.
I'm reining it in!
You're reining it in?
I'm reining it in. Okay. It's too much. Mm-hmm. It's just films from now on. Just films.
Films only.
Not even that. Just images. I watched this great film in Berlin. Yeah. Uh-huh. It was called I Am Not Everything I Want to Be.
Oh, that's a really good title.
Yeah. I had to remember it right. It's a...
I'm Not Everything I Want to Be.
Yes.
Okay.
Lovely poster too.
Oh, good.
Not to judge a book by its cover, but you can judge that book by its cover because it's a smashing cover. It's a documentary about a Czech photographer. Mm-hmm. She's described in the closing credits as a Czech Nan Goldin, which I was so heartened to see on the screen because that had been my entire thought throughout the whole watching of it. And she was like, photographing queer nightlife and stuff in the 70s, 80s onwards. And it's a documentary made up entirely of her photography. So there's no like talking heads shots of, you know,
like people. A PowerPoint presentation.
Well, there's none of that traditional documentary. No, not like a PowerPoint.
No,
oh,
but
reductive.
No.
There's no swipe transitions.
That would be great. No, but in a similar way to all
it's
the
all
beauty and the
bloodshed. Static imagery. Yeah. It's that, but for the whole runtime. Mm. And it's so crisply edited to the soundtrack and score, which is great. They've used this really contemporary score, which has like some kind of almost techno sequences to it, and then they do this really crisp intercutting between her kind of stills photography, her shots.
Cool.
With voiceover throughout. Okay. Beautiful. Probably one of the best things I saw there, and I watched it in, as I've been banging on about, my new favourite cinema ever, the Kino International.
Oh yeah, with
what
the blue
a building.
Seats. Blue seats.
Blue seats.
With the blue seats.
On Karl Marx Alley, this massive brutalist concrete block. It's beautiful.
It
also
is
the best
beautiful.
Ceiling of any auditorium I've seen.
Is that
in
the
a
wavy,
long
wavy
the wavy light
yeah.
ceiling. Anyway, really great doc. Also, as part of the documentary, well, she wants to live in Berlin for mm-hmm. a while, back in like the 80s, I think it was, late 80s. Or maybe it was early 90s. Either way, she has a green card marriage to a German man mm-hmm. So that she can then stay in Berlin. She, I don't think, meets him until the wedding day and never sees him again after the wedding day. Still technically married because they never divorced. And who did they bring out at the surprise Q&A at the end? But her husband.
Oh, wow.
They were like, and our special guest. And Ta-da. Then they just came up from the audience and she was like...
That's
is that?
Great.
I know. It was great. It was like a little soap opera moment. It was stunning. Oh no, the best of that like live TV, like, and if we look to the audience.
Oh, well, who's this?
This is your long lost child, that kind of thing. Yeah, great evening. Can't wait to show it. Hoping it gets distributed soon.
Hey, well, I went to watch Barbie last week and I thought it was bloody great. It's the seventh time that I've watched it.
Did you have fun?
It is such a good film.
Excellent.
It very much resonated with me once again and I was like, oh yeah, that was great. Oh yeah, that was great. Oh yeah, that was great. I don't think we'll ever have the time when we have like a sellout cinema of Barbie fans in there, because I think that was what was
until
really
the sequel.
Barbie 2, Barbie Harder.
No, actually it would be for the Barney film that apparently is in the works.
Barney, oh yeah, with
Barney the Purple Dinosaur.
Daniel Kaluuya.
Yeah.
Now I'm very interested in what the trailer will
reveal.
Yeah, but I'm still a Barbie girl.
In a Barbie world. Mm-hmm. I don't know the rest of the lyrics.
It's fantastic.
Plastic?
And fantastic.
There we go. March.
March.
She's plastic. She's fantastic.
She's moisturised.
She's glowing. She's thriving.
She's here.
She's raining it in.
She's raining it in, and she's raining, literally pouring, raining.
Yeah.
It's raining outside at time of recording.
What a lovely note to end on. We'll be back next month for the April podcast.
Yeah.
Hopefully on time next month.
Apologies for the delay, everyone.
4 months.
Thank you for tuning in. I've been Steph. Who have you been?
The devil. Steph. And thank you, producer Bernie.
Thank you, producer Bernie.
As ever. Legend.
Talk to you soon. Goodbye.
Au revoir.